reading from Isaiah chapter 8, and if you're using the Turquoise Church Bibles, that is on page 694. So starting at verse 19 and going through into chapter 9 and verse 7. When someone tells you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? Consult God's instruction and the testimony of warning. If anyone does not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn. Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. When they are famished, they will become enraged, and looking upwards, they will curse their king and their God. Then they will look towards the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honour Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be a fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Amen.
This is the first of four messages for Advent. We're holding on a Sunday morning up to Christmas Day. The theme is Christmas songs, and today we're looking at a Christmas song of hope from Isaiah chapter 9. I think you would have had to have been living in a cave in North Wales, possibly Snowdonia, to not know that on Tuesday there is a debate concluding and a vote being taken in a place about 150 miles from here that will impact your life and my life in ways that we have no idea about yet. For 2 years on the media, there has been one word that has come back time and time and time again, and the word is uncertain. Life is uncertain. We have had probably 50 plus years of reasonable stability and peace in our land. We haven't been threatened very much by other people. We've had probably for many an increase in their standard of living. And depends on who you listen to as to what is going to happen post-Tuesday. If you think it's not serious, I would wake up. It's serious. There is a thing called the locus of control. Have you heard of locus of control? Locus means center. And so it's the center of control. I hold my hand up. I'm a control freak. Absolutely control. I love having a locus of control. Just what I do. I have no control over Tuesday. I voted. You presumably voted 2 years ago. Since then, no control. Who knows where we're headed? There is a political instability, insecurity and uncertainty. There is an economic uncertainty. As a Christian, I also identify over the last few years a change in the religious atmosphere of the country. There is a greater sense of the rejection of God as any involvement in life at all. And even where there is, there's a degree of religious pluralism that is there all the time. Just in case you think I'm going to make a political broadcast of this, which I'm not, I need you to understand that what is happening in our country today, now, Sunday, the 9th of December, 2018, is an absolute mirror of what happened in Judah 800 years before Jesus was born. It is an absolute mirror. And we need to understand that. If we're going to recite Isaiah 9, we have to understand the context. And the context is ours. So we're going to go to a map. Here you go. The year is 740 BC. We know that because Isaiah writes in Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. And Uzziah, the king of Judah, died in 740 BC. So we know when it's based, we know when it is, it's not a problem. We know that Isaiah ruled for 40 to 50 years in Judah, and they had a time of stability and security as a nation. They were fine. There was a growing living standards within the country. We know that as well. So we know that their past 50 years mirrors our past 50 years. We're fine. But then Uzziah died. And the several kings that followed him brought about a time of insecurity and uncertainty politically and economically. And around them, there were nations that began to emerge that had been there before, but had been held, as it were, held back for a while, now began to emerge. And so you get places like Assyria. Assyria was coming to the forefront as a major empire over the next 50, 100 years. They were going to be major. And they were beginning to threaten places like Aram and Syria, which was basically kind of combined here. But then also Israel, which is here, northern kingdom of Israel, that's Galilee, and Judah, based around Jerusalem here. And they were threatening. And they began to see their safety in alliances, putting countries together to protect each other against somebody else. And so they began to put Aram and Israel had an alliance against Assyria. And they asked them, would Judah join it? And Judah, one of the kings, said, no, we're not going to join that at all. And they wouldn't join with Israel and Aram. And instead, they joined with Assyria. Clever people. No, they weren't. It was against Isaiah's advice. Because for the next 50, 60 years, they paid a lot of money to Assyria. Tribute money. And what that meant was that the economic prosperity of Judah began to decline. Businesses didn't trade like they used to. It's really interesting. If you don't understand what's happening today, you'll never understand what's happening here, and you'll never see the relevance of Isaiah. Because actually, the prophets of the Old Testament have an immense impact on our lives today if we'll listen to them. If we'll understand the context in which they spoke, we will begin to have a message for today. Because Isaiah wasn't a hermit. He didn't wear odd clothes like John the Baptist and eat locusts and honey. Isaiah was a courtier. He lived in the palace in Jerusalem. He was right in the heart and the seat of government. He knew what was happening in Judah. And God used him and spoke through him to the people. It was that clear. So within Isaiah's lifetime, the northern kingdom is invaded. It just ceases to exist. It's taken off the map entirely. And Isaiah spoke into this time of political change, economic uncertainty, and religious apostasy. And Isaiah begins his ministry in that context. Now, before we read the message of hope, can you go on to the next one? Thanks. That's the one. Thank you. Before we read of the hope, we need to understand more fully the problem. And Ruth very kindly read from Isaiah 8, the last verse of Isaiah 8. And it's on the screen for you here, or it should be. Yes, it is. That's fine. And we've already read it, so I won't read it again. But just to highlight something, just first couple of lines. When someone tells you to consult means and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? Consult God's instruction and the testimony of warning. And because this is Isaiah observing his people. In times of trouble and uncertainty, people will try anything to find personal security. Have you noticed that? Of course we will. Of course we will. And in the 8th century BC, they turned to the spirit world of the dead. That's where they went, to the mediums and the spiritists. And Isaiah rightly asked the question, shouldn't people inquire of their God? Why do you consult the dead about the living? Go to the God of the living. But they didn't. They went elsewhere. And the spirit world, far from bringing security and peace to their hearts, only increased the problem. Because a wrong response to the external circumstances and the national uncertainties that are around us, a wrong response will only compound the inner problem we have. The inner darkness of the heart and the mind, and the inner uncertainties, if you go to the wrong place. And the first consideration then, in these times of national crisis, is who should we turn to? Well, later in the book of Isaiah, in chapter 40, Isaiah answers his own question. It's really interesting. He returns to it. And what he says is, he suggests, for example, he says, well, why don't we go to the nations? Perhaps the nations will help us in this time of uncertainty. And then he says, why don't we go to the gods who are made of wood and metal and covered over with gold? Why, perhaps they'll help us. And then he says, why don't we go to our national leaders? Perhaps they'll help us in these times of uncertainty. And each time he concludes that the nations and the gods of the nations around them and our national leaders will not actually eventually help us. They are not the answer to the problem. And what he says is that he begins to say, God through Isaiah says, to whom will you compare me? Who's my equal, says the Lord. And he goes on to describe in Isaiah 40 that the God of the Bible, the God of Isaiah, and the God of the people, if they'd only recognize it, is the one who created the universe, who has all the power and all the might and all the possibility of being an answer to every uncertainty we've got, but we will not go to him. That's the issue. So we'll go anywhere except him. And it's into this context of political uncertainty and religious pluralism that Isaiah brings a message of hope. And it was utter darkness, remember. So verse 1 of chapter 9, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. Don't you just love little words in the Bible? Just little words. Nevertheless. Great word, nevertheless. Especially when you just had this description of gloom and darkness. Nevertheless, it means there's an answer. It means there's a contrast coming. There's something else going to happen. A lovely word, nevertheless. The gloom that hangs over the people is going to be lifted. Now, we need to just go back for a minute and just explain something, because otherwise we don't understand verse 1. Can we go back to slide 3, please? It's the map. Whoop. And again. No, that's the one. That's it. Okay, this is Galilee here, yes? Zebulun and Naphtali are next door and adjacent to Galilee here. All right? That's the area that Isaiah is speaking to in Isaiah 9:1. And he says that this country here, this part of the country here, is going to be honored. It was called Galilee of the Nations. In some Bibles, it's called Galilee of the Gentiles. And that's because the people in this area here, all around here, this was quite a prosperous place. They moved there to live there. And actually, the Jewish population weren't necessarily the majority. Okay? It was a Gentile land. So they called them Galilee of the Gentiles or Galilee of the Nations. And the people in Jerusalem, who were the religious people, who were the God-fearing religious people, who always did what God said. No, he didn't, but they thought they did. They looked at Galilee and they scorned them. They laughed at them. This was the land of the Gentiles. Galilee of the Gentiles. And it was called the way of the sea because all the nations here, when they fought the nations down here that aren't on the map, they went straight through here. And they really got hammered. Every time a country went to war with somebody else, they marched straight through Galilee. And that's called the way of the sea. It was a nickname of the place, the way of the sea. Okay? But they were ridiculed by the people in the south because they were in the north. And God says, I'm going to honor Galilee. Thanks very much. You can go back now. Thank you. So do you get the idea? He's going to honor them. Now think about it for a minute. Where was Mary living when the angel spoke to her about the birth of a baby? Nazareth. Nazareth is in Galilee. Where did Jesus grow up until he was 30 as a carpenter in Galilee? Oh, interesting. Where did Jesus begin his ministry? Luke chapter 4, in the synagogue, opened up the scroll from Isaiah. Where was that? Capernaum. Galilee. Galilee is the place where God chose to live, humanly speaking, and grow up from a baby into a man, God himself. And God took the despised place that was looked down on and ridiculed by the religious people, and he prophesied 800 years before it would happen that God would raise up this despised place and give it a place of honor because God would be there. Not in Jerusalem, not in the capital city where everyone thought, you know, the religious people were and the temple was there. No, Galilee. That was the place to be. So he's going to honor it. So we come to this idea that, so we can go on now into verse 2. Thank you. It continues this to address the issue of darkness. So it says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those who are in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You've enlarged the nation, increased their joy. They rejoice before you as a people, rejoice the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. Remember, the utter darkness that these people are in, that is described in Isaiah 8 and at the beginning of Isaiah 9, is the result of rejecting God as their help. They've gone somewhere else for their answers. And it's darkness, and it's their own problem. They brought it about. They're the result of their own lack of thought. But the light that is promised, that's going to break into the darkness, is at the initiative of God, not the people. They're walking in darkness, But God is providing an alternative, a great light that will penetrate the darkness. And you remember that Jesus, one of the things Jesus said about himself, I am the light of the world. I am the light of the world. So this is the light that's coming. But you also have to recognize, don't you, that darkness is real. We choose darkness. John 3:19, Jesus observed, people love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. Many years ago, at Christmas time, our daughter, when she was very small, about 2 years old, 2.5 years old, we had in the front room, we had a Christmas tree, you know, lights and all, and it was a real one. So that, and in those days, they didn't you spray them, so all the needles dropped off. If you touched it, the thing just fell apart. It was crazy, really. Anyway, so we said to Sarah, you don't touch the Christmas tree, okay? Don't touch the Christmas tree. Don't touch the Christmas. Went into the front room one morning, and our daughter just saying, and I said, Sarah, you touched the Christmas tree. No. Sarah, you touched the Christmas tree? Sarah, what's that little ball doing, swinging around then, and the branch moving if you've not touched it? No. What did they do? Listen, I'll tell you what they do. She heard me coming. What did she do? What her finger was touching. I know it was, actually. I mean, she said it afterwards. So. Hands behind the back. Why? Not my hands. Not my hands. No. Hide my hands. Well, hide my hands. That's a 2-year-old girl, right? As adults, we do far worse things than that, and we run for the darkness. We will hide. Why? Because light shows up problems. It shows up rebellion. It shows up all kinds of things. And we run for the dark because we don't like the light to reveal things. Jesus was so right. We love darkness. We still choose darkness. We don't choose light. But light has come. Light is penetrating the darkness. And we need to come to it. The promise is there, and it's very clear. And to help us understand it, Isaiah gives us two illustrations. This is, the gloom is going, guys. Joy is coming. Happiness is coming. There's going to be real joy here, and there's two illustrations. And the first one is the harvest is gathered. When the joy that comes when the harvest is gathered. Now, we have a problem with this. It is a problem, because culturally, we don't identify here. This is not real for us. I can buy strawberries in January. This is not limited anymore to Wimbledon fortnight. Anytime I want, I can buy strawberries. Go to the shop, strawberries are there. Might pay more money for them, but they're there. I can buy any food I want. Go to the store any time of the year. We're not seasonally adjusted. Anytime at all. But 800 years before Jesus was born in Judah, if the harvest failed, 3 months later, people died of starvation. There was no other way of feeding themselves. The harvest was crucial. In fact, it still is. In some parts of the world today, it's still true. We were driving through Malawi, and we were one of our staff who ministered there, and we were driving from Blantyre to Lilongwe, and we're going along. He said, look at that field there. Look at that field there, and that field there, and that field there. And it was just brown. The crop was just brown and withered. And he said, the thing is, the rains came too early, and the roots rotted in the ground. And then when they finally sprouted and the sun came, the rain didn't come, and it just shriveled the plants up. And he was just talking about it, and he suddenly said, with great feeling, he said, the thing is, this winter, they'll die. The people will die. That's Isaiah 9, And Isaiah's point is, the gloom is lifted just like when the harvest is in. And the harvest is there, and the people know they can eat through the winter, and they can have seeds to plant for the following spring, for the next harvest. And there is joy here. This is fantastic. So there's joy, isn't there? Wonderful. And the second illustration is the battle, the warrior who goes over the battlefield, and they've won. And they collect all the belongings of those who've died. And there are two reasons why they're joyful. One is they're alive. The battle's finished and they're still alive. That's the cause for joy. And the other one is they're going to get wealthy. Because there's a lot of stuff left on a battlefield when people die on a battlefield. There's armor and there's all kinds of things. Gold they've been carrying. And it's yours for the taking. And the illustrations of harvest and the battle are there to help us understand the contrast between the darkness and the gloom and the joy and the light that is coming. And the people would really have connected. There's no problem with the connection of it. But now he brings a word of caution. Verse 4 says, "For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor." Got it? That's a specific reference to Judges chapter 7 and Gideon. It's absolutely crystal clear. In Judges, before Isaiah's time, Israel had been very susceptible to raids from different nations around them. One of them were the Midianites. And the Midians would wait until harvest was in. This is the same as the harvest. The harvest was in. And they'd store that, and then they'd come over the hill on the horses, and they would raid, and they'd take the harvest back to Midian, and the Israelites would starve. And it happened time and time again. And in the end, God said, "Listen, I'll give you a deliverer, a judge who will take away the threat of the Midianites." And he raised up a man called Gideon. And Gideon, In response to God saying, "You know, you're a mighty man of valor and want you to get rid of the Midianites," he called right around the nation and said, "If you're happy to fight, if you're willing to fight in my army, come join me." 32,000 men joined him. That's a lot of people. A lot of fighting men. Makes you feel very secure. And God said, "Gideon, too many. Tell you what, why don't you just say to them, if you're afraid, go home." "If you're afraid, go home." 22,000 men went home. But he still has 10,000, so that's okay. 10,000, it's not a bad number to fight with. Okay, feel quite confident with 10,000 men. So God said, actually, send them down to the river, go to the river, and drink. Okay, tell them to drink. If they drink like a dog would, you know, it's put their head in the water and lap the water up, put them on one side. If they put their hand in, bring the water to their mouth, put them on that side. Seems a bit crazy, but okay, all right. So he said, "Guys, have a drink." That side, 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 that side. That side, 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 that side. Listen, 9,700 on that side, 300 on this side. Gideon thinks, great, got 9,700 men. No, God said, "They go home. You fight with the 300. Now he's got a problem, because now he's insecure and he's very uncertain about what God has in mind. But what happened is that night, with 300 men, they went down to the Midianite camp and they were all sleeping, and they surrounded the Midianite camp, 300 men, and in this hand they had a torch, which was covered over, and in this hand they had a trumpet. And Gideon said, "When I tell you, smash the jar over the torch, so the torch, they can see the torch, blow the trumpet. Now, smash the church, blew the trumpet. The Midianites wake up, panic, fight each other, kill each other. And Gideon wins the battle without even fighting. Don't even, nothing, with 300 men. No, he didn't. No, God won the battle, not Gideon. And here's the issue of Isaiah 9. This is why the word of caution is in it. This is why Midian is mentioned in Isaiah 9. Is because in your uncertainty and in your fear of the future and what is going to happen, when it's sorted out, don't say, I did it. The lesson is, God does it. God is in charge of this thing. God is in charge for Gideon. God is in charge for us. It's just a hard lesson to learn because we like to be secure all the time. But there are times of insecurity as well, and we're not sure what's going to happen. But in those days, we can be certain that in God's economy, he is still sovereign. Let me tell you a very quick illustration. I spoke with a couple this week who are mission partners, and a number of years ago now, they went through as a family, I think, the worst experience I could ever imagine. So think about the worst thing and multiply it three times. They went through it. It was horrendous. It was awful. So on Thursday, I said, you know, what? How did you cope with that? Because they did. They're wonderful. I said, how did you cope with that? And the wife said to me, it was the sovereignty of God. I said, what do you mean the sovereignty? Oh, she said, before we ever went on the mission field, we studied, read, and prayed, and drew a conviction on what we believed about the sovereignty of God. And we have a conviction that whatever happens, God has never lost control. So the bottom line was, it was awful. But God knew about it. And he never left us. Got it? Do you understand where this is coming from? The insecurity and the uncertainty is there. But the light has come and is coming. This is the whole point of Isaiah. It's coming. And the light will shine and God is sovereign. It is there. Okay. That was a whole cul-de-sac in my... what I was going to tell you. But there we go. There's a lesson to think about. Okay. So now we go into familiar territory. Verse 6. The promise of a son. We've already seen two reasons for joy. Galilee is going to be honored. And war is going to cease. Because that's what it says. It's going to stop. He shattered the bow and... the boots of the warriors and the bloodstained clothing of the warriors is going to be burnt, and there's going to be peace now. We're going to come to that in a minute. So we've seen that. How's it going to be accomplished? Well, by the birth of a baby, a son given by God, and he will carry the government of his people on his shoulders. And we're going to come to that in a minute, but there's a profile. We need to just look at this profile of the child. Four titles, two words for each title. Very quickly, here we go. Wonderful counselor. Wonderful means not of this world. It means a counselor is someone who is a wise person who speaks into the situations of a nation. A wonderful counselor is someone who brings the counsel of God, the wisdom of God, to the people and of a nation. And Jesus, this son to be born, is going to be a wonderful counselor. It's interesting, isn't it? That the people commended Jesus' wisdom. In Matthew 22, we read this account of how they tried to trap him and just get hold of him and just trick him and make him say silly things. But he says, verse 18, but Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. Because they wanted to know whether they should pay the poll tax. And they brought him a denarius, and he said, whose image is this? Whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. He said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed. Of course they were. Of course they were. They were trying to trap him, trick him in saying something that he didn't mean, that they could use against him. And his wisdom, the wisdom of God, applies to the people. So when your tax bill arrives at the end of January and you need to pay it, if you pay that way, like I do, pay the bill, guys. Give to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what's God's. It's okay. Jesus said it and it's fine. Then you're into mighty God, you see. And suddenly the first thing we notice here is the divine nature of this child. This is God. This is not just man. This is God. It speaks of his power and his authority. In Matthew 28, before commissioning his followers, he said, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me." This is a divine ruler. Paul, writing in Colossians 1:16, says, "For in him all things were created," in Jesus this, "things in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities." There is no one, there is no place that has greater power and greater authority than Jesus does. He's the mighty God. Cardiff Assembly doesn't. British Parliament doesn't in London. Moscow doesn't. Dare I say Washington doesn't? This is the mighty God who is coming. All authority, heaven and earth, every power, throne, rule and authority submits to him. I know whose side I want to be on. Then you have everlasting Father. I'm so pleased this is here. This is wonderful that God would just give him the title of Everlasting Father, because it's the nature of a child who is to be born both a warrior, strong on our behalf, and a father who loves us, cares for us, and protects us. The conversation between Mary and Jesus, Mary the sister of Lazarus, at the death of her brother is very special. John 11, when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died." Can you hear it? Do you hear the emotion? Do you hear just the heart-rending of this woman who's lost a very dear brother? "And when she saw her weeping and the Jews had come along with her weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied. Jesus wept." This is the warrior king who cries at the death of a friend, who loves and supports and cares for us. And it's not just a passing moment. This is for eternity. He will always care, always love us, always protect us. So in all the uncertainty of the present and the future, we're held by a Father who will never let us go. Eternally his. Then you come to Prince of Peace. We need to be careful with this. We see peace as a cessation of fighting. But in the Old Testament, the word for peace was shalom. And it's a lovely word, shalom. It means wholeness, harmony, completeness. It means that as peace hovers over us, we live in harmony both with God and with people. And Jesus, as the one who is to come, is the initiator of that possibility. We mentioned earlier this child will carry the government on his shoulders. And Isaiah takes David's reign as king over united Israel. He's an example, as a model to be held up. And David did. When David was king of Israel, it was a time of great stability. His kingdom was the widest it would ever be. Israel would never be bigger than in the time of David's reign. And no one ever attacked. For years, there was no surrounding nation would ever dare to attack Israel. The people lived in peace and security and harmony. It was good. It was good. But it ended. It did end. David died. They were back to civil war within months. But with this king, with this King Jesus, there is no end to his reign. It is eternal. And it's justice and righteousness that will be part of his reign. You will never be able to say to Jesus, "That's not fair. What you decided then isn't fair." You can't say that. You won't be able to say that to Jesus, because this reign is one of justice and righteousness. He always does what is right, and he never shows partiality, always impartial. And then you come to this last phrase, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. And you realize that it's almost a commentary on the question, who can do it? Who can do all of this? Who can provide stability and security and peace and contentment when I'm living in a land like I'm living now with Tuesday coming? And who knows? Who can provide this? Who can bring light into that darkness? And the commentary answers itself, of course, because the Lord Almighty will bring it about. Not the authorities, not the government, not the nation, not other nations, not other gods. Our God will bring it about. So in space and time and history, this child came to be born. And we celebrate his birth over the next few weeks. But be careful. This prophecy isn't completed yet. The message of hope is still alive and is still relevant, because we wait for his second coming. The events that will follow his second coming will bring this prophecy in Isaiah 9 to its full completion. Yes, it is completed in his first coming to the extent that he came. But the establishment of his reign and authority and kingdom forever is yet still to come. When every knee will bow is still yet to come. So we need to be careful that we're aware that it's not over yet. Because his second coming will be very different to his first coming. The first time, Mary had 9 months' notice of that. His second, it'll be an instant. No warning, no waiting. It'll just happen. The first time as a baby, he was dependent in every way. Did you hear the song we sang? This child dependent in his mother's arms as a baby, dependent, totally dependent. Not next time. Next time he comes as a majestic king. Comes from heaven with all the authority belonging to him and being displayed by him. The first time, rooted in a locality, in Bethlehem, Judea, and then in Galilee as he grew up. This time, global, universal. Every eye will see him when he comes this time. And the second coming will result in all things being new. The ruling of the king over the establishment of a government that will never end. We won't need to vote for this government. It will be established. There are twice as many promises about his second coming than there are about his first. And he did come the first time. No wonder the penultimate verse in the Bible has John saying, "Come, Lord Jesus." Times of uncertainty and insecurity does not lessen the promise of a secure and certain future, where Jesus reigns with wisdom, power, loving care, and established peace. That's the future for those on whom the light has dawned, from Isaiah 9. This promised son ought to encourage in us and increase faith, security, and identity as his people, building confidence in us to trust the God who made the promises, and then to live in the light of his presence with us now and his future return. This is indeed Isaiah 9, a Christmas song of hope.